Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, the Retina Podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 104, I am joined by Dr. Ajay Kurian of the University of Rochester. We review the May issue of Retinal Physician, available online at retinalphysician.com, focusing on surgically oriented articles regarding bimanual vitrectomy, diabetic vitrectomy, management of dropped crystalline lenses, and new instrumentation. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Ajay Kurian, who is an assistant professor at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, and he joins me today to discuss the May issue of Retinal Physician. Ajay, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Jay. Thanks for having me on again.
So we're recording this on Wednesday, April. What day is today? Tuesday. Tuesday, April 24th. Now, it's always a bad sign when you don't know what day of the week it is. Tuesday, April 24th. This issue is going to post online on May 1st, 2018. So we're a little bit in advance, but that's fine. The bigger thing is, for those of you who care about basketball, we're going to spend the last 5 to 10 minutes talking about the NBA playoffs. If you don't care about basketball, which I think is actually the majority of our listening base, about 20 minutes in is about when you can turn your brain off and stop listening, because we're going to offer completely uneducated and unfounded predictions, and which will all be probably proven wrong by the time this episode posts on Monday. So the first article we're going to talk about, and again, the function of these podcasts is not just to, unlike our Journal Club articles, episodes, to provide a summary of the articles, but more just to kind of discuss, and then people want to read the articles, they're all available at retinalphysician.com online for free. The first article is about bimanual vitrectomy. It's entitled Bimanual Tissue Manipulation in Vitrectomy Using Active Instruments in Both Hands Can Enhance Efficiency and Outcomes. Akshay Thomas, who's a fellow at Duke, along with Leila Vizovich, who was a previous collaborator on the show and attending at Duke, wrote this article. I'll just quickly summarize. They essentially just go through the different options for bimanual surgery, starting with both chandelier systems, and there's several available from Alcon, Bausch & Lomb, Dork, Eckard. And then when they employ bimanual vitrectomy, what are some scenarios that you can use bimanual vitrectomy? And there's several, and they go through kind of all the different options and kind of the range of things you can do. I'll start with this question, Ajay. How often do you employ bimanual vitrectomy?
Pretty rarely, actually. The most common scenario which I employed is for traction retinal detachments with a regmatogenous component. I find that, especially with that lack of counter traction, when you have that regmatogenous component, you're trying to dissect those membranes off, it's helpful to have a bimanual technique. You know, they do a great job of highlighting a bunch of times where it's really useful. And can sometimes make things a little bit easier, but I actually find that I use it a lot less often now that I tend to rely more on small gauge vitrectors for some of those tough TRDs.
And when you talk about using bimanual, are you using it with the chandelier or using a lighted pick?
So I actually do both techniques depending on how the membranes are, but for really tight membranes, I tend to actually prefer using the lighted pick. Because I find that it's just very effective at just reflecting that tight membrane and getting that small space that you can just keep cutting away at that tight fibrovascular membrane, especially if it's a combined regmatogenous traction retinal detachment.
Right. And, you know, in fellowship, we did a lot of our tractional retinal detachments with the lighted pick. Now that I'm attending, I feel like I use the cutter more often. As the cutter technology has improved, I feel I'm using bimanual techniques less and less. But I do think that if you have the option, a chandelier can be very helpful. Lighted pick is a useful thing to learn how to use if you're a fellow or an attending on practice, just to have in your toolbox. I agree with you. I don't use bimanual techniques as often as maybe they describe here. But again, some of the scenarios they're describing are very, very specific. For example, they talk about IOL placement with the Amani technique, or removal of IOFBs, or even something that you've done, which is tacking of the Argus prosthesis. These are scenarios that, in general, most of us aren't encountering on a daily basis. But it's useful to know how to use both hands because I found, especially when I've exposed fellows to using both hands, there is an adjustment. You think it would be easier to use both hands together, but once you've trained to use only one hand and have a light pipe, the lighting is different, the angles are different. Whether it's a lighted pick or chandelier, there is an adjustment period to moving to bimanual technique.
Yeah, there certainly is an adjustment period, and certainly I would encourage all the fellows who are listening to try to do as much as possible with bimanual technique, just because that way you just feel more comfortable doing it. You know, like you pointed out, there's certainly some scenarios when it's really useful, like the Argus, for example. It makes a huge difference, I think, in terms of ease for tacking with the bimanual technique compared to trying to do it just with one hand. It's just nice to be able to move the implant right where you want it, hold it in place, and be able to come down with the tack. But I think for a lot of times where bimanual techniques used to be really important, like you were saying, with this new evolution of vitrector probes, we've really minimized the need for it in a lot of situations.
Right. I think the other thing is that we don't really think as a bimanual technique is using something we've done very commonly is the end of these cases, especially tractional cases where it may be difficult to dry a posterior break and apply a laser around it. Is you can use using the endo laser light while aspirating with the soft dip. The Constellation lets you kind of do laser and aspiration with the soft dip simultaneously if you can get the foot gymnastics right. So that actually is a bimanual technique. I wouldn't have even thought of it as being bimanual, and they kind of describe that here.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So moving on, and again, this whole issue is essentially surgical, which is nice, because the last few issues we've just had more mostly medical discussions. And this actually features, again, someone who's been on the program. Maria Barakal wrote this article. It's about essentially approaching vibrovascular membranes and her approach to these cases, which she described when she came on the podcast. Aja, you just want to take us through the kind of bare bones of what she described here, and then we can talk about what we apply to our practices?
Sure. So this is a great article just going over her techniques for approaching these diabetic tractional retinal detachments. You know, she's a master at these, and I think anybody who's viewed some of her videos or see her talk at conferences is easily wowed by her ability. And so it's nice to have her write down a bunch of her pearls. And so she really talks about different techniques. She really emphasizes how she uses much more cutter Oley based approaches because of these changes to the vitreous, to the cutter probes. And so she talks basically how oftentimes she tries to find an opening and starts working in there. And she describes a technique that she uses where she goes into that space, creates a little bit more space, and then can cut as she's backing out. And so that seems to be very effective at trying to minimize the amount of retina getting into your cutter probe. And then she describes a common scenario where there's just no opening. And so in those cases, she tends to start at the nerve, create some space, and then work from the inside out to open up some more space. You know, she does emphasize some points about using some bimanual technique in situations like a combined regmatogenous and tractional retinal attachment as well. And so she goes over using the chandelier or using the lighted pick as well. And so she had some really great points. I think it's a great article to review to just go over some pearls for approaching these tough cases.
I think that we've talked about this before, but her videos are exceptional. If someone has not seen her videos and they read this article, I think a lot of her videos are up on iTube and are worth looking into if you have a tough TRD. Even if we can't match her skills, Maria Barakal is an exceptional surgeon. And you know, when you can talk about maybe if there are breaks, I do this versus for the breaks, I do this, I think it's already a big jump. But if you want some inspiration, kind of looking to higher ability level that we all want to aspire to, I think those are great videos. I think the most useful thing I've learned from her is just the more you play with the small gauge cutters, the more efficient you can get using them. Like anything, there's no manual essentially for using these cutters. There's no rule book for using these cutters. There's basic rules about if you're doing a detachment, like a regmatogenous detachment, you know, don't point the port right at detached retina going with maximum aspiration duty cycle. But in terms of these TRDs, you can use the cutter in so many different ways. The cutter can be used for blunt dissection. It can be used at different cutting speeds. She always talks about using at maximum cutting speeds, but there may be moments for very thick membranes with a lower cutting speed, with a high duty cycle where the ports open quite a bit, like a momentary or dense mode may be very useful. So there are different ways to learn how to use the cutter that I think just experience teaches you, and the more you do it, the better and easier it gets.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think that, you know, she talks about how you can leave behind some of these nasal membranes, which I think is definitely true. You can certainly leave them behind a lot of times, as long as you clear all the vitreous around it. But sometimes when you're trying out some of the techniques with the cutter that you haven't used over in the past, sometimes it's helpful to try to use it on some of those nasal membranes. And so you're a little bit less worried about creating a break in those situations. And so I find that that's sort of where I sort of tested my limits and pushed myself further with the small gauge vitrectomy cutters and also with the beveled probe, which I find to be really helpful for these TRD cases. And so I tried to do it on the nasal side just so I could feel more comfortable and then move it over to the macula once I feel comfortable with it.
The next article, again, we're going to hit these pretty quickly, not to toot our own horn, but Mike Venenkasa of this program, along with myself and Rahul Tonk, who's one of my anterior segment cornea colleagues here at Bascom, we wrote up this article. They want us to review essentially how to approach drop lenses at the anterior segment surgeon as the posterior segment surgeon. We can focus more on the posterior segment side, but the anterior segment side is actually fairly useful because sometimes we'll end up doing these complex cases and we have to deal with the anterior chamber as well. But Ajay, at the risk of just me saying what I wrote here, how do you approach dislocated or crystalline lens? Let's say you get referred a dropped crystalline lens. What is your surgical approach? What's your thinking before you take the patient to surgery, and what conversation do you have with the patient?
So I think, you know, I definitely want to do a very good exam to make sure that the posterior pole is looking good and there's no problems with the peripheral retina and no detachments. You know, as you pointed out in this article that sometimes the traction induced by using the phaco emulsification probe before you realize that there's perhaps a posterior capsule rupture, or if you're aggressively going after some of those pieces, can cause significant vitreous traction, can lead to breaks and detachments. And so I think that's one of the first things. Sometimes these patients have really bad corneal edema, so it makes the view pretty poor. And so I usually, if I can't see everything as well as I'd like, I usually use ultrasound to make sure everything is looking good in those situations. If the cornea is really cloudy, I tend to, as you recommended in the article, use some medical management to try to clear up the cornea a little bit, unless I think it's the lens that's just causing the corneal cloudiness and it's just not going to get better. And then sometimes I go in a little bit sooner. But, you know, I think you hit some great points in this in terms of the preoperative evaluation. I think those are all some of the key things that I think about. I often try to determine how dense the lens is to decide if I am planning on using a fragmentome in the case or if I think I can just get it with the cutter. And sometimes I use like a 23-gauge cutter if I think it's going to be a little bit too tough for the 25-gauge cutter, for example.
Well, in tribute to Dr. Flynn, who always reminds us to think about what when you don't operate, when do you decide not to operate on these cases?
Yeah, you know, if the lens material appears like it's mostly cortical, I tend to give it a little bit of time as long as they're not having any other issues with elevated intraocular pressure or persistent corneal edema. I tend to give it a little bit of time and see how it does. And a lot of times it does just improve by itself if it's not the nuclear material. But if they're having any of those other issues like elevated pressure, a lot of inflammation or corneal edema, I think that sort of pushes your hand to need to intervene a little bit sooner than later if they're not responding to the topical therapy.
Right. It's like I tell our fellows, similar in a way, it's a management of hemorrhagic choroidals, for example. Having lens material alone is not an indication to take someone to surgery, especially if it's cortical, like you said. Are they having pressure issues that aren't controlled with drops? Are they having persistent inflammation despite topical steroid therapy or consideration of injection of steroids, corneal edema? Or is the patient very symptomatic? I mean, sometimes the patients will just, if they have large amounts of lens material, they'll have large shadows in their vision that aren't improving. They're very unhappy. Then it may make sense to go in earlier. Otherwise, we've both seen cases where cortex and even epinucleus, which will take a long time to go away, but they'll both melt away. It just may take months for them to go away.
Yeah.
You know, my thing I try to teach people is surgically, when you do these cases, once you decide, first of all, one of the biggest points is don't chase the lens material initially. So make sure you start your vitrectomy. Make sure you clean the vitreous. Make sure if they had a broken capsule that you, even if I like using a triamcinolone towards the end of the case to make sure, but make sure you clean the anterior chamber. Make sure there's no persistent vitreous kind of coming towards the corneal wounds and into the AC. And then once you clean the vitreous, make that decision whether or not to use the frag. You can take nuclear fragments of the cutter. it tends to be slower. If it's very large fragments, it may take you a significant amount of time or not really eat the very dense material. Once you decide to make a frag incision, do you typically pull a port and enlarge it to fit the larger 19-gauge frag, or do you just make a separate wound?
You know, I often make a separate wound. I just make a localized perdomy in between my two temporal ports, and then I just make a sclerotomy there. And then once I finish with the frag work, then I just suture it back up, and I find that that way I just have good stability for the whole rest of the case.
Right. I like that as well, because just in case something comes up later in the case, there's a break you need the laser, there's anything else you need to do, I like to keep it neat and clean. Make your frag incision. Remember, the MVR plate is usually 20 gauge. You need to slightly enlarge the incision as you come out to make it 19 gauge until the frag will fit. Otherwise, you'll really have problems going in and out. Make sure before you make that wound that you've cleaned that site with your cutter so you're not dragging gel as you come in with the frag. And then using the frag is a very psychedelic experience for the first time you see it or the first time you do it. I mean, especially this is where maybe a bimanual technique would make it less psychedelic. But if you're using your light pipe in the frag, every time you kind of use the light pipe to either push the lens or manipulate it or kind of turn the lens on the frag to avoid the lollipop effect, which is when you bore through it. You bore through it with this 19-gauge frag. And even if you're doing 23-gauge vitrectomy, now if you're on full aspiration boring through the lens and you're just aspirating water from the vitreous cavity, you're going to outrun an infusion very quickly. And that's where it can be dangerous, and you can run into the retina on the other side where you don't visualize. So learning to use the light pipe and handle that kind of intermittent changing of your lighted view is a different experience. And the biggest thing I've seen, I think this could be potentially very dangerous if you're just not careful about watching your aspiration.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And sometimes it does make sense to turn up your infusion higher during that process, just in anticipation of sometimes outrunning your infusion.
That's a great point. You know, the other thing is, there's been reports of these drop lens cases with a frag where there's commotion of the retina after, and you try to minimize how many times, if you have a very dense lens, you do drop it and you pick it back up and you drop it. You don't want to keep dropping it on the posterior pole. So kind of like your phaco skills, learning to kind of go from the phaco and the frag to the aspiration, the phaco and the frag to the aspiration. So as you phaco through it, you reposition the lens. You're not dropping it, but you're just re-grasping it with a lower amount of aspiration rather than just coming off the pedal completely and having the lens fall. You can use a momentary mode too if you want, especially if you're starting, you're teaching fellows to start. That's where you kind of separate the phaco pendant from the aspiration power of the pedals from the constellation. Then the pedal just becomes pure aspiration. And if you want them to phaco, you have them just hold the pedal to the right. Therefore, you kind of separate those movements out so they can focus on one at a time. But it is useful as you progress to kind of get it all on the one pedal like you did when you learned how to phaco.
Yeah, I think definitely trying out the two different settings for the frag is helpful, especially during training, just so you can see what you're more comfortable with, and that might evolve over time.
What do you do about secondary IOLs in these cases? I'm curious. Do you sometimes tell the patient that you may leave them aphakic? How do you make a decision for an anterior chamber lens versus an iris suture, scleral sutures? I mean, what is your kind of game plan when you get in these cases? Let's assume a lens was not placed at the time of the original surgery and they're aphakic.
Yeah, so I always tell the patients that that's a possibility just to repair them. And oftentimes, unless there's really bad corneal edema, I'll go ahead and put in a secondary IOL at the time. The only thing that sometimes holds me back is if the corneal edema is just too great and I'm just trying to clear out the lens material, do a good vitrectomy to be able to calm the eye down, and then that way I can come back in later to be able to see what I need to see in order to be able to do the fixated IOL. I usually do either the George Williams technique with the scleral fixated three-piece intraocular lens, or I do the Acrios fixated technique. Oftentimes, it depends on the amount of retinal pathology. If I'm thinking that the patient might need subsequent procedures, or is at higher risk for retinal detachment, if they have had a previous history of trauma, or if they have extensive lattice or anything like that, then I tend to use the George Williams technique just so we don't have to worry about the opacification of the acrios. But if they have an otherwise pristine retina and I could do a good peripheral shave and I feel comfortable with how things are, then I go ahead and do the acrios.
And the reason I ask that is that kind of, you have to pre-play it at the beginning of your case, where you place your ports, where you plan to put your frag. So you have to kind of go through that mental exercise even as you sit down. You can't just put your ports wherever you want them and decide halfway through that you're going to put a Gore-Tex lens or the George Williams technique and you realize that your ports aren't in the right position, assuming you don't want to put extra ports to do a trocar-assisted delivery of the haptics.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of times if I'm doing the procedure not on the same day, then I usually come in with my game plan beforehand. If I'm doing a same day vitrectomy as the drop lens, sometimes I just go ahead and put in the extra two ports for superior and inferior and just do the George Williams technique after I take a look and see how everything is looking.
And then we can't forget, sometimes the sulcus is available and maybe sufficient. So how do you evaluate for sulcus support as a retinal surgeon? What's your easy, quick, dirty technique for that?
So I usually use the like some sort of hook to manipulate the iris if the iris has come down at this point from all the previous manipulation, just temporarily, so like a Sinsky hook or a Kuglin hook, just to move the iris over to make sure I can visualize it, that there is really good sulcus. Inject some viscoelastic in there to make sure that the zonules are intact as well. And if it does look like there's enough clock hours of sulcus support, then I think that that's definitely the best way to go.
Right, and I think once you actually put the lens in the sulcus, or if there's a lens in the sulcus and you're trying to evaluate stability, once you've cleaned the vitreous behind, if you can create some turbulence just by aspirating with the cutter or create some turbulence around it, because what you don't want to do is leave a lens that may be shaky and then you clear out, and then what you don't want to see is the next day or a couple days later in the office, the lens isn't where you wanted it to be. So I kind of try to test it without physically touching it, just create some fluid turbulence to see is that lens going to shift around or is it centering nicely.
Yeah, that's a great idea to get an idea to make sure that you don't need to do any more work.
So let's move on to the last article. And the last article is, again, feeding into this idea of surgical techniques. It's about new instrumentation and what we are going to see going forward. So I'll just quickly summarize. This was by Carolina Francescioni and David Chow, was titled What's New in Vitreoretinal Instrumentation? New Designs, Cut Rates, and Port Migration Aimed to Increase Efficiency. It talks about the different cutters and how our cutters work now. It talks about the beveled cutter, which you mentioned. It talks about the HyperVit probe that's coming out with a 20,000 cut rate. It talks about dual port cutters like we see with the Stellaris, as well as the TDC color with the DORC, hypersonic vitrectomy, which is a very hot topic with the VITESSE, and then the viewing systems that are available, including disposable biome and newer light pipes and things that are more easy or easier for us to use, different types of forceps that are coming out, things that we ne not necessarily have been exposed to. I think some of these things are, for example, 3D printer customized retinal forceps, not something that a lot of us have had a chance to use. And finally, laser probes. And our laser for options with probes, there's the articulated probes, and then there are now 27 gauge probes from Vector, which was something that was lacking before in terms of being illuminated laser probes. Ajay, in terms of the things here, have you had an opportunity to use any of these, and what are your thoughts on them?
Yeah, so the one that I've had the most opportunity to use is the beveled probe from Alcon, which I think is fantastic for being able to approach some of those bad TRDs. It just makes using only the cutter even easier, and it further decreases my need for going to bimanual with those changes that they have for that probe. I've used the bi-blade cutter. I think that definitely helps improve the flow, especially for the small gauge, higher cut vitrectors that are there with those platforms. Those are the main ones that I've used, but I think, you know, whenever I've used in the wet lab, the VITESSE, which was very impressive with the new technology that they have there also. I think the best thing is just seeing how fast all this stuff is evolving and how much it's almost inspired by surgeons who recognize a problem in the OR and then come up with an idea for how to address it. And then, fortunately, the companies in the space are pretty adaptable, and they're open to getting that kind of feedback and offer these newer instruments and these changes, which I think is one of the most exciting things about being in retina. We're just seeing the field evolve so much, both surgically and medically.
Right. It's crazy. If you think back to when we were residents, which is getting longer ago, but wasn't that long ago. Just the tools we're using are completely different. And then I think back to when I was a medical student and starting in ophthalmology. I remember, you know, everything at the VA where I was rotating was time domain OCT, even in the clinic. And now we have swept source, and we have such better clarity of what we're doing. This is all quickly. I think we take it for granted when we're in training. But now that we're out and we're kind of seeing the progression, you really have to stay current. It's exciting. It also demands much from us because we got to stay current. If you don't stay current, then you're not offering your patients the best possible care.
Yeah, and articles like these are actually great to introduce you to some of these new technologies that I hadn't even heard about. And so there's definitely a few that I circle that I'm going to talk to my surgical nurse to start ordering so that we can start getting these in my OR.
What was your favorite one that you haven't tried yet?
So the green poly tip. So I use it for subretinal TPA and submacular hemorrhage displacement, and I've always said how I wish that there was color on that tip so we can visualize it easier, and now it turns out that there is, and I actually didn't even know that existed. And so for me, that's one of the most useful ones, but I'm really interested in trying out those curved forceps as well, because that makes a lot of sense how you can actually visualize a lot better if the tip is just a little curved exactly where you're grasping.
I don't necessarily know what the benefits are, but I just love the Morris Honey Badger forceps. The fact that they named it the Honey Badger is amazing.
That name did stick out to me.
You know, like the ones around it, there's the Morris ILM forcep, there's the 27 gauge wide grip extended reach forcep, and you have the Honey Badger. I just would love to ask for the Honey Badger if I'm in the OR. Bring me some Honey Badger. All right, Ajay, well, thanks so much for going through these. Again, if you like these articles, you want to read more, we didn't go through everything in exhaustive detail. Articles are all available for free online at retinalphysician.com, especially, I think, the What's New article, like you said. I also did similarly when I read this. The advantage of doing the podcast forced me to keep up and read these and circle the ones that I think I'd want to try or want to look for at my next meeting that I attend. Ajay, before we go, we got like 5 minutes. This is where the audience turns their ears off and is like, God, these guys are going to talk about MBA. But we're going to talk about the MBA. So, two questions for you. The first question, who are the Knicks going to hire as their coach?
We're interviewing so many people.
I feel like you
no
should
idea.
Interview. I feel they should interview Eddie from the movie Eddie. They should interview you, John Chang. I don't know.
Yeah, I think at this point,
Dean Elliott should coach the Knicks.
There's probably less people that have been not interviewed for the Knicks job than have been interviewed for the Knicks job.
It's a nice Venn diagram circle, right? I agree.
As long as it's not Mike Woodson or Mark Jackson, I think I'd be. at this point, this is what it comes down to as being a Knicks fan. You just think about what the worst case scenarios are, and you hope that it's not that.
Well, full respect for Mike Woodson. I don't think Mike Woodson was a bad coach, and he did a really good job in Atlanta. And I do think that there's a ceiling to how good he could be with the team. I don't think it was his fault that team was bad. That team was just bad. But you've got to get new blood. And I love the idea. I don't know how much it's been discussed. I think Becky Hammond would be amazing. I think Jay Wright is very interesting. As long as they don't poach Eric Spoelstra in a reverse Pat Riley scenario with a fax letter.
that would be amazing if that happened.
Well, the modern fax would be an Instagram post with a tweet. Say, see you later. Playoffs. So this is... As of Tuesday, we're confirmed it's Tuesday, April 24th. This is all probably going to be proven wrong by next Monday. So I'm going to run through the series quickly. You tell me who you think is going to win. Rockets up on the Wolves 3-1. We both think the Rockets finish in 5, right?
Yeah.
Warriors-Spurs 3-1. Warriors going to finish in 5.
Yes.
Pelicans already swept. And then we have the Jazz-Thunder 3-1 up on your favorite Carmelo Anthony and his band. I'm going to say Jazz in 6.
That's actually what I would say, too. So I actually pegged the Thunder to beat the Jazz. I thought that their playoff experience would overcome the Jazz's relative inexperience. But I've been surprised. These Jazz are the real deal. I think they're going to take it in 6.
The Donovan Mitchell is amazing. And Ricky Rubio is much better than he used to be. I don't know what they did to him where he could learn how to shoot, but he's much better. So we're looking at Rockets-Jazz, Pelicans-Warriors. Do you think anything stops Rockets-Warriors?
I don't think so. I think that Rockets team is just real talented, and they're made for playoff basketball.
Wow, that was the most cliched answer since Mark Jackson. you're ready to coach the Knicks, Ajay. We played hard. Both teams played hard. And so if we look east, Celtics, Bucks, 2-2. Raptors, Wizards, 2-2. Cavs, Pacers, 2-2. Heat, my poor Heat. I went to the playoff game this weekend, and super sad. But my poor Heat are down 3-1 against the Sixers. I think that one is the only one that's definitely done. What do you think about the other three series? Do you think all the favorites win? Any of the underdogs win?
So I think the Cavs are going to pull it out. It's crazy how much LeBron has had to do to keep this as 2-2. But I think that they will pull it out eventually. The Raptors Wizards, that's really a toss up to me. I don't know who's coming out of that. And similarly with the Celtics Bucks, it's just tough with the injuries the Celtics have had to face. I think the Bucks might be able to pull out there.
Celtics Bucks is interesting because with all the injuries, the Celtics are definitely less talented, but they're so much better coached and so much more disciplined. And they still have home court. I feel like that's a series that they could win in seven games, and then they'll just get rolled by the Sixers in the next round because they just don't have the talent. The Sixers are really, really good. Like, that was the one thing that stood out to me. They're just super talented. Bellinelli and Ilyasova was super, super cheat to get them in the middle of the season like they did for nothing. J.J. Redick is really, really good. And I'm not even talking about Embiid or Simmons or Markel Fultz, whatever he's giving them off the bench, and Covington. This is a good, good team, and they're very well coached, and they're super talented. I think Wizards-Raptors is hard because the Wizards are the most confusing team in the league, I think. I think they could beat anyone, and they can lose to anyone. And John Wall, every time I think he's terrible, he plays well. Every time I think he's good, he does something really boneheaded. I think this is a series the Wizards blow in seven. I feel it's going to be one of those series where they're up like eight in game seven with like a quarter to go. The only mitigating factor is I think the Toronto crowd gets really nervous, and I think that could hurt the Raptors at home. I think it'd be similar to the Knicks. You know, if a crowd's been burnt too many times, they get almost bad for a team to be in front of them. And the Raptors are not overwhelmingly talented. I mean, the Wizards have the better backcourt, I think. I'd rather have John Wall and Bradley Beal than Lowry and DeRozan.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think there's more talent on the Wizards, but the Raptors have played together for a longer time, and so I think that they're going to have the edge there, but I think it's going to be real close.
And then finally, Cavs-Pacers, this has been a very odd series. The Cavs are really bad. Either that or the Pacers are just a bad matchup for them. The Cavs are really not that good. I mean, LeBron is playing 46 minutes the other night. If he doesn't score or assist, they can't score. They have no one else in their team who can generate their own shot consistently. I just don't see. The East is weak enough. I don't trust the Raptors. I don't trust the Wizards. I don't see. I could see anything. I could see the Cavs losing the next two and LeBron leaves. I could see them getting to the conference finals. I don't see them beating the Sixers if the Sixers are playing this way. I just think the Sixers are better at this point. They have more talent and they're more. It just depends if Embiid's not 100% with this face thing because he's not shooting well since he broke his face. But I think that if I had to pick it, I would pick Raptors, Celtics. I pick all the favorites, and then after that I think the Sixers are coming out of the East. I've been saying that since we started talking about this. I might die on this hill, but I think the Sixers are really, really good.
Yeah, the Sixers are really, really good. I think it's going to be tough to see who comes out of the East. It's always hard to bet against playoff LeBron, but when you're seeing them struggle this much against the Pacers, this might be the year that he doesn't make it through the East.
Well, and then what about playoff Rondo? Are you going to pick the Pelicans to do anything against the Warriors without Curry?
No, I think the Warriors are just too good.
I still think the Warriors are going to win the title. I think the Rockets, there's been things that have been exposed against Minnesota. I know they're up 3-1. I know they scored 50 points in the third quarter last night. I don't think Minnesota is that good or that well coached. I'm sorry, Tom Thibodeau. I don't think trust him. I don't think that team plays right. I think that team, the fact that they've made it as competitive as they had against the Rockets is more an indictment of the Rockets than a compliment to the Wolves. I think the Jazz are going to give the Rockets major trouble. I think the Rockets I think that could go 6 or 7. I'm going to say that goes 7 and the Rockets win because I think the Jazz at home are going to be really, really difficult to beat. That crowd is arguably the best crowd in the league. They're really, really good. And then I don't think the Rockets have enough to beat the Warriors. If Curry's back and he's 80% of what he is, I think that this whole season we've been talking and talking and talking. I think the Warriors are still going to end up winning. They may go to 6 or 7 in a couple of these series, but I just don't see how they lose barring injury.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Warriors are going to make it out. I think it'll be Rockets versus Warriors,
but
I think they're going to take it.
Don't forget Knicks 2019. Knicks,
that's right.
Keep saying it. All right, Ajay. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to come on the program, and I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Take care, Jay. Thank you for having me. Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 104 episodes, including this one, can be found there, sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better, things we are already doing well. We appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Ajay Kurian for joining me. Thanks to Jennifer Ford and the team at Retina Physician for providing the articles in advance for our team's review. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.